I've been working on this nonstop for a week, Barsh said. You probably have been wondering where I disappeared to, so I figured it was time to show you what I've got. McPherson stopped just a few steps inside the door and stared, squinting her eyes and revealing to Barsh her vanity. She needed glasses, but he'd never seen her wearing them. Haller stepped over to the table, where there were several archival case boxes gathered. He slowly pulled out a chair to sit down. Maggie, Barsh prompted, why don't you sit down? McPherson finally broke from her stare and took the chair at the end of the table.
Is this what I think it is? She asked. They all look like Melissa Landy.
Well, Barsh said, let me just go over it and you'll draw your own conclusions.
Barsh stayed on his feet. He moved around the table to the whiteboard. With his back to the board, he started to tell the story.
Okay, I have a friend. She's a former profiler. I've never...
For whom? Haller asked.
The FBI, but does it matter? What I'm saying is that I've never known anybody who was better at it. So shortly after I came into this, I asked her informally to take a look at the case files, and she did. Her conclusions were that back in 86, this case was read all wrong. And where the original investigators saw a crime of impulse and opportunity, she saw something different. To keep it short, she saw indications that the person who killed Melissa Landy may have killed before.
Here we go, Haller said.
Look, man, I don't know why you're giving me the attitude, Barsh said. You pulled me in as investigator on this thing, and I'm investigating. Why don't you just let me tell you what I know? Then you can do with it whatever you want. You think it's legit, then run with it. You don't, then shit can it. I will have done my job by bringing it to you.
I'm not giving you any attitude, Harry. I'm just thinking out loud. Thinking about all the things that can complicate a trial. Complicate discovery. You realize that everything you were telling us has to be turned over to Royce now.
Only if you intend to use it.
What?
I thought you'd know the rules of discovery better than me.
I know the rules. Why did you bring us here for this dog and pony show if you don't think we should use it?
Why don't you just let him tell the story, McPherson said, and then maybe we'll understand.
Then go ahead, Haller said. Anyway, all I said was, here we go, which I think is a pretty common phrase indicating surprise and change of direction. That's all.
Continue, Harry, please.
Barsh glanced back at the board for a moment and then turned back to his audience of two and continued.
So my friend the profiler thinks Jason Jessup killed before he killed Melissa Landy and most likely was successful in hiding his involvement in these previous crimes.
So you went looking, McPherson said.
I did. Now remember our original investigator, Kloster, was no slouch. He went looking too. Only problem was, he was using the wrong profile. They had semen on the dress, strangulation, and a body dump in an accessible location. That was the profile. So that is what he went looking for, and he found no similars, or at least no cases that connected. End of story. End of search. They believe Jessup acted out this one time, was exceedingly disorganized and sloppy, and got caught.
Harry turned and gestured to a row of photographs on the whiteboard behind him.
So I went a different way. I went looking for girls who were reported missing and never showed up again. Girls reported as runaways, as well as possible abductions. Jessup is from Riverside County, so I expanded the search to include Riverside and L.A. counties. Since Jessup was 24 when he was arrested, I went back to when he was 18, putting the search limits from 1980 to 86. As far as victim profile, I went Caucasian, age 12 to 18.
Why did you go as old as 18? McPherson asked. Our victim was 12.
Rachel said... I mean, the profiler said that sometimes starting out, these people pick from their own peer group. They learn how to kill, and then they start to define their targets according to their paraphilias. A paraphilia is...
I know what it is,
McPherson said. You did all of this work yourself? Or did this Rachel help you?
Nah, she just worked up the profile. I had some help from my partner pulling all of this together. But it was tough, because not all the records are complete, especially on cases that never got above runaway status, and a lot was cleared out. Most of the runaway files from back then are gone.
They didn't digitize? McPherson asked.
Boss shook his head. Not in L.A. County. They prioritized when they switched over to computerized records and went back and captured records for major crimes. No runaway cases unless there was the possibility of abduction involved. Riverside County was different. Fewer cases out there, so they archived everything on computer. Anyway, for that time period in these two counties, we came up with 29 cases over the six-year period we're looking at. Again, these were unresolved cases. In each, the girl disappeared and never came home. We pulled what records we could find, and most didn't fit because of witness statements or other issues. But I couldn't rule out these eight.
Bosch turned to the board and looked at the photos of eight smiling girls, all of them long gone over time.
I'm not saying that Jessup had anything to do with any of these girls dropping off the face of the earth, but he could have. As Maggie already noticed, they all have a resemblance to one another and to Melissa Landy. And by the way, the resemblance extends to body type as well. They're all within 10 pounds and 2 inches of one another and our victim.
Bosch turned back to his audience and saw McPherson and Holler transfixed by the photographs.
Beneath each photo I've put the particulars, he said. Physical descriptors, date, and location of disappearance, the basic stuff.
Did Jessup know any of them? Holler asked. Is he connected in any way to any of them?
That was the bottom line, Bosch knew. Nothing really solid. I mean, not that I've found so far, he said. The best connection that we have is this girl.
He turned and pointed to the first photo on the left.
The first girl, Valerie Schlichter. She disappeared in 1981 from the same neighborhood in Riverside that Jessup grew up in. He would have been 19 and she was 17. They both went to Riverside High, but because he dropped out early, it doesn't look like they were there at the same time. Anyway, she was counted as a runaway because there were problems in her home. It was a single-parent home. She lived with her mother and a brother, and then one day, about a month after graduating from high school, she split. The investigation never rose above a missing persons case, largely because of her age. She turned 18 a month after she disappeared. In fact, I wouldn't even call it an investigation. They more or less waited to see if she'd come home. She didn't.
Nothing else?
Bosch turned back and looked at Holler. So far, that's it.
Then discovery is not an issue. There's nothing here. There's no connection between Jessup and any of these girls. The closest one you have is this Riverside girl, and she was 5 years older than Melissa Landy. This whole thing seems like a stretch.
Bosch thought he detected a note of relief in Holler's voice. Well, he said, there's still another part to all of this.
He stepped over to the case boxes at the end of the table and picked up a file. He walked it down and put it in front of McPherson.
As you know, we've had Jessup under surveillance since he was released.
McPherson opened the file and saw the stack of 8x10 surveillance shots of Jessup.
With Jessup, they've learned that there is no routine schedule, so they stick with him 24/7. And what they're documenting is that he has two remarkably different lives. The public one, which is carried in the media as his so-called journey to freedom. Everything from smiling for the cameras and eating hamburgers to surfing Venice Beach to the talk show circuit.
Yes, we're well aware, Holler said, and most of it orchestrated by his attorney.
And then there's the private side, Bosch said. The bar crawls, the late-night cruising, and the middle-of-the-night visits.
Visits where? McPherson asked. Bosch went to his last visual aid, a map of the Santa Monica Mountains. He unfolded it on the table in front of them. 9 different times since his release, Jessup has left the apartment where he stays in Venice and in the middle of the night driven up to Mulholland on top of the mountains. From there, he has visited one or two of the canyon parks up there per night. Franklin Canyon is his favorite. He's been there 6 times. But he also has hit Stone Canyon, Runyon Canyon, and the overlook at Fryman Canyon a few times each.
What's he doing at all these places? McPherson asked.
Well, first of all, these are public parks that are closed at dusk, Bosch replied. So he's sneaking in. We're talking 2-3 o'clock in the morning. He goes in, and he just sort of sits. He communes. He lit candles a couple of times. Always the same spots in each of the parks, usually on a trail or by a tree. We don't have photos because it's too dark and we can't risk getting in close. I've gone out with the SIS a couple of times this week and watched. It looks like he just sort of meditates.
Bosch circled the 4 parks on the map. Each was off Mulholland and close to the others. Have you talked to your profiler about all this? Holler asked.
Yeah, I did, and she was thinking what I was thinking. That he's visiting graves, communing with the dead, his victims.
Oh, man, Holler said.
Yeah, Bosch said.
There was a long pause as Holler and McPherson considered the implications of Bosch's investigation. Harry, has anybody done any digging in any of these spots? McPherson asked.
No, not yet. We didn't want to go too crazy with the shovels because he keeps coming back. He'd know something was up, and we don't want that yet.
Right. What about
cadaver dogs? Yeah, we brought them out there undercover yesterday.
How do you make a dog go undercover? Holler asked.
Bosch started to laugh, and it eased some of the tension in the room. What I mean is, there were 2 dogs, and they weren't brought out in official vehicles and handled by people in uniforms. We tried to make it look like somebody walking their dog, but even that was a problem because the park doesn't allow dogs on these trails. Anyway, we did the best we could and got in and got out. I checked with SIS to make sure Jessup wasn't anywhere near Mulholland when we went in. He was surfing.
And? McPherson asked impatiently.
These dogs are the type that just lie down on the ground when they pick up the scent of human decay. Supposedly, they could pick it up through the ground even after 100 years. Anyway, at 3 of the 4 places Jessup's gone in these parks, the dogs didn't react. But at one spot, one of the 2 dogs did.
Bosch watched McPherson swivel in her seat and look at Holler. He looked back at her, and there was some sort of silent communication there.
It should also be noted that this particular dog has a history of being wrong, that is, giving a false positive, about 1/3 of the time, Bosch said. The other dog didn't react to the same spot.
Great, Holler said. So what does that tell us?
Well, that's why I invited you over, Bosch said. We've reached the point where maybe we should start digging, at least in that one spot. But if we do, we run the risk that Jessup will find out, and he'll know we've been following him. And if we dig and we find human remains, do we have enough here to charge Jessup?
McPherson leaned forward, while Holler leaned back, clearly deferring to his second chair. Well, I see no legal embargo on digging, she finally said. It's public property, and there is nothing that would stop you legally. No need for a search warrant. But do you want to dig right now, based on this one dog, with what seems like a high false positive rate, or do we wait until after the trial?
Or maybe even during the trial, Holler said.
The second question is the more difficult, McPherson said. For the sake of argument, let's say there are remains buried in one or even all of those spots. Yes, Jessup's activities seem to form an awareness of what is below the earth in the places he visits in the middle of the night. But does that prove he's responsible? Hardly. We could charge him, yes, but he could mount a number of defenses based on what we know right now. You agree, Michael?
Haller leaned forward and nodded. Suppose you dig, and you find the remains of one of these girls. Even if you can confirm the ID, and that's going to be a big if, you still don't have any evidence connecting her death to Jessup. All you have is his guilty knowledge of the burial spot. That is very significant, but is it enough to go into court with? I don't know. I think I'd rather be defense counsel than prosecutor on that one. I think Maggie's right. There are any number of defenses that he could employ to explain his knowledge of the burial sites. He could invent a straw man, somebody else who did the killings and told him about them, or forced him to take part in the burials. Jessup spent 24 years in prison. How many other convicts has he been exposed to? Thousands? Tens of thousands? How many of them were murderers? He could lay this whole thing on one of them. Say that he heard in prison about these burial spots, and he decided to come and pray for the souls of the victims. He could make up anything. He shook his head again. The bottom line is, there are a lot of ways to go with a defense like this. Without any sort of physical evidence connecting him or a witness, I think you would have a problem.
Maybe there is physical evidence in the graves that connects him, Bosch offered.
Maybe. But what if there isn't? Haller shot right back. You never know. You could also pull a confession out of Jessup, but I doubt that too. McPherson took it from there. Michael mentioned the big if, the remains. Can they be ID'd? Will we be able to establish how long they were in the ground? Remember, Jessup has an ironclad alibi for the last 24 years. If you pull up a set of bones, and we can't say for sure that they've been down there since at least 86, then Jessup would walk. Haller got up and went to the whiteboard, grabbing a marker off the ledge. In a clear spot, he drew two circles side by side. Here's what we've got so far. One is our case, and one is this whole new thing you've come up with. They're separate. We have the case with the trial about to go, and then we have your new investigation. When they're separate like this, we're fine. Your investigation has no bearing on our trial, so we can keep the two circles separate. Understand?
Sure, Bosch said.
Haller grabbed the eraser off the ledge and wiped the two circles off the board. He then drew two new circles, but this time they overlapped. Now if you go out there and start digging and you find bones, this is what happens. Our two circles become connected. And that's when your thing becomes our thing, and we have to reveal this to the defense and the whole wide world. McPherson nodded in agreement.
So then what do we do? Bosch asked. Drop it?
No, we don't drop it, Haller said. We just be careful, and we keep them separate. You know what is universally held as the best trial strategy? Keep it simple, stupid. So let's not complicate things. Let's keep our circles separate and go to trial and get this guy for killing Melissa Landy. And when we're done that, we go up to Mulholland with shovels.
Done with?
What?
When we're done with that.
Whatever, Professor. Bosch's eyes moved from Haller's connected circles on the board to the row of faces. All his instincts told him that at least some of those girls did not get any older than they were in the photos. They were in the ground and had been buried there by Jason Jessup. He hated the idea of them spending another day in the dirt, but knew that they would have to wait a little longer.
Okay, he said. I'll keep working it on the side, for now. But there's also one other thing from the profiler that you should know.
The other shoe drops, McPherson said. What? Haller had returned to his seat. Bosch pulled out a chair and sat down himself.
She said a killer like Jessup doesn't reform in prison. The dark matter inside doesn't go away. It stays. It waits. It's like a cancer. And it reacts to outside pressures.
He'll kill again, McPherson said. Bosch slowly nodded.
He can visit the graves of his past victims for only so long before he'll feel the need for fresh inspiration. And if he feels under pressure, the chances are good he'll move in that direction even sooner. Then we'd better be ready, Holler said. I'm the guy who let him out. If you have any doubts about him being covered, then I want to hear them.
No doubts, Barsh said. If Jessup makes a move, we'll be on him.
When are you planning on going out with the SIS again? McPherson asked.
Whenever I can. But I've got my daughter, so it's whenever she's on a sleepover or I can get somebody to come in.
I want to go once.
Why?
I want to see the real Jessup, not the one in the papers and on TV.
Well.
What?
Well, there are no women on the team, and they're constantly moving with this guy. There won't be any bathroom breaks. They piss in bottles.
Don't worry, Harry. I think I can handle it.
Then I'll set it up.
Chapter 21. Friday, March 19th, 10:50 a.m. I checked my watch when I heard Maggie say hello to Lorna in the reception room. She entered the office and dropped her case on the desk. It was one of those slim and stylish Italian leather laptop totes that she never would have bought for herself. Too expensive and too red. I wanted to know who gave it to her, like I wanted to know a lot of things she would never tell me. But the origin of her red briefcase was the least of my worries. In 13 days, we would start picking jurors in the Jessup case, and Clive Royce had finally landed his best pretrial punch. It was an inch thick and sat in front of me on my desk. "Where have you been?" I said with a clear note of annoyance in my voice. "I called your cell and got no answer." She came over to my desk, dragging the extra chair with her.
"More like, where were you?"
I glanced at my calendar blotter and saw nothing in the day's square.
"What are you talking about?"
"My phone was turned off because I was at Haley's Honors Assembly. They don't like cell phones ringing when they are calling the kids up to get their pins."
Oh, shit.
She had told me and copied me on the email. I printed it out and put it on the refrigerator, but not on my desk blotter or into my phone's calendar. I blew it.
"You should have been there, Holler. You would have been proud."
I know. I messed up.
"It's all right. You'll get other chances. To mess up or stand up."
That hurt. It would have been better if she had chewed my ass out like she used to. But the passive-aggressive approach always got deeper under the skin. And she probably knew that. "I'll be at the next one," I said. "That's a promise." She didn't sarcastically say, "Sure, Holler," or "I've heard that one before." And somehow that made it worse. Instead, she just got down to business.
"What is that?"
She nodded at the document in front of me. "This is Clive Royce's last best stand. It's a motion to exclude the testimony of Sarah Ann Gleason.
And of course he drops it on a Friday afternoon, 2 weeks before trial."
"More like 13 days.
"My mistake. What's he say?"
I turned the document around and slid it across the desk to her. It was held together with a large black clip. "He's been working on this one since the start because he knows the case comes down to her. She's our primary witness, and without her, none of the other evidence matters. Even the hair in the truck is circumstantial. If he takes out Sarah, he takes out our case."
"I get that, but how's he trying to get rid of her?"
She started flipping through the pages. "It was delivered at 9 and is 86 pages long, so I haven't had the time to completely digest it. But it's a two-pronged effort. He's attacking her original identification from when she was a kid. Says the setup was prejudicial. And he..."
"That was already argued, accepted by the trial court, and it held up on appeal. He's wasting the court's time."
"He's got a new angle this time. Remember, Kloster's got Alzheimer's and is no good as a witness. He can't tell us about the investigation, and he can't defend himself. So this time out, Royce alleges that Kloster told Sarah which man to identify. He pointed Jessup out for her."
"And what is his backup? Supposedly only Sarah and Kloster were in the room."
"I don't know. There's no backup, but my guess is he's riffing on the radio call Kloster made
telling them to make Jessup take off his hat. It doesn't matter. The lineup was put together to see if Sarah could identify Derek Wilburn, the other driver. Any argument that he then told her to put the finger on Jessup is ridiculous. That ID came quite unexpectedly, but naturally and convincingly. This is nothing to get worked up about. Even without Kloster, we'll tear this one up.
I knew she was right, but the first attack wasn't really what I was most worried about. That's just his opening salvo, I said. That's nothing compared with part two. He also seeks to exclude her entire testimony based on unreliable memory. He's got her whole drug history laid out in the motion, seemingly down to every chip of meth she ever smoked. He's got arrest records, jail records, witnesses who detail her consumption of drugs, multiple partners' sex, and what they term her belief in out-of-body experiences. I guess she forgot to mention that part up in Port Townsend. And to top it all off, he's got experts on memory loss and false memory creation as a byproduct of meth addiction. So in all, you know what he's got? He's got us fucked coming and going. Maggie didn't respond as she was scanning the summary pages at the end of Royce's motion. He's got investigators here and up in San Francisco, I added. It's thorough and exhaustive, Mags. And you know what? It doesn't even look like he's gone up to Port Townsend to interview her yet. He says he doesn't have to, because it doesn't matter what she says now. It can't be relied upon. He'll have his experts, and we'll have ours on rebuttal, she said calmly. We expected this part, and I've already been lining ours up. At worst, we can turn this into a wash. You know that. The experts are only a small part of it. We'll be fine, she insisted. And look at these witnesses, her ex-husbands and boyfriends. I see Royce conveniently didn't bother to include their own arrest records here. They're all tweakers themselves. We'll make them look like pimps and pedophiles, with grudges against her because she left them in the dust when she got straight. She married the first one when she was 18, and he was 29. She told us. I'd love to get him in the chair in front of the judge. I really think you are overreacting to this, Holler. We can argue this. We can make him put some of these so-called witnesses in front of the judge, and we can knock every one of them out of the box. You're right about one thing, though. This is Royce's last best stand. It's just not going to be good enough. I shook my head. She was seeing only what was on paper and what could be blocked or parried with our own swords, not what was not written. Look, this is about Sarah. He knows the judge is not going to want to chop our main witness. He knows we'll get by this. But he's putting the judge on notice that this is what he is going to put Sarah through if she takes the stand. Her whole life, every sort of detail, every pipe and dick she ever smoked, she's going to have to sit up there and take it. Then he'll trot out some PhD who will put pictures of a melted brain on a screen and say this is what meth does. Do we want that for her? Is she strong enough to take it? Maybe we have to go to Royce. Offer a deal for time served and some kind of payout from the city. Something everybody can live with. Maggie flopped the motion onto the desk. Are you kidding me? You're running scared because of this? I'm not running scared. I'm being realistic. I didn't go up to Washington. I have no feel for this woman. I don't know if she can stand up to this or not. Besides, we can always take a second bite of the apple with those cases Bosch has been working. Maggie leaned back in her chair. There's no guarantee that anything will come out of those other cases. We have to put everything we have into this one, Holler. I could go back up there and hold Sarah's hand a little bit, tell her more about what to expect, get her ready. She already understood it wasn't going to be pretty. To put it mildly, I think she's strong enough. I think in some weird way, she might need it. You know, get it all out there. Expiate her sins. It's about redemption with her, Michael. You know about that. We held each other's eyes for a long moment. Anyway,
I think she'll be more than strong, and the jury will see it, she said. She's a survivor, and everybody likes a survivor. I nodded.
You have a way of convincing people, Mags. It's a gift. We both know you should be lead on this, not me.
Thank you for saying that.
All right, go up there and get her prepped for this. Next week, maybe. By then, we should have a witness schedule, and you can tell her when we'll be bringing her down.
Okay, she said.
Meantime, how's your weekend looking? We have to put together an answer to this. I pointed at the defense motion on the desk.
Well, Harry finally got me a ride-along with the SIS tomorrow night. He's going too. I think his daughter has a sleepover. Other than that, I'm around.
Why are you going to spend all that time watching Jessup? The police have that covered.
Like I said before, I want to see Jessup out there when he doesn't think anyone is watching. I would suggest that you come too, but you've got Haley.
I wouldn't waste the time.
But when you see Bosch, can you give him a copy of this motion? We're going to need him to run down some of these witnesses and statements. Not all of them were in Royce's discovery package.
Yeah, he played it smart.
He keeps them off the witness list until they show up here. If the judge shoots down the motion saying Gleason's credibility is a jury question, he'll come back with an amended witness list saying, okay, I need to put these people in front of the jury in regard to credibility.
And she'll allow it, or she'll be contradicting her own ruling. Clever Clive. He knows what he's doing.
Anyway, I'll get a copy to Harry, but I think he's still chasing those old cases.
Doesn't matter. The trial is the priority. We need complete backgrounds on these people. You want to deal with him, or do you want me to? In our divvying up of pre-trial duties, I'd given Maggie the responsibility of prepping for defense witnesses. All except Jessup. If he testified, he was still mine.
I'll talk to him, she said.
She furrowed her brow. It was a habit I'd seen before. What?
Nothing. I'm just thinking about how to attack this.
I think we throw in a motion in limine, seeking to limit Royce on the impeachable stuff. We argue that the events of her life in between are not relevant to credibility if her identification of Jessup now matches her identification back then.
I shook my head. I would argue that you're infringing on my client's Sixth Amendment rights to cross-examine his accuser. The judge might limit some of this stuff if it's repetitive, but don't count on her disallowing it. She pursed her lips as she recognized that I was right. It's still worth a try, I said. Everything is worth a try. In fact, I want to drown Royce in paper. Let's hit him back with a phone book to wade through. She looked at me and smiled.
What?
I like it when you get all angry and righteous.
You haven't seen anything yet. She looked away before it went a step further.
Where do you want to set up shop this weekend? She asked. Remember, you have Haley. She's not going to like it if we work the entire weekend.
I had to think about that for a moment. Haley loved museums, to the point that I was getting tired of going to the same museums over and over. She also loved movies. I would need to check and see if a new movie was out. Bring her to my house in the morning, and be prepared to work on our response. We can maybe trade off. I'll take her to a movie or something in the afternoon, and then you go on and do your thing with the SIS. We'll make it work.
Okay, that's a deal.
Or
what?
You could bring her over tonight, and we could have a little dinner celebrating our kid making second honors. And we might even get a little work on this done.
And I stay over. Is that what you mean?
Sure, if you want.
You wish, Holler.
I do.
By the way, it was first honors. You better have it right when you see her tonight.
I smiled. Tonight? You mean that?
I think so.
Then don't worry. I'll have everything right.
Chapter 22. Saturday, March 20th, 8 p.m. Because Bosch had mentioned that a prosecutor wanted to join the SIS surveillance,
Lieutenant Wright arranged his schedule to work Saturday night and be the driver of the car the visitors were assigned to. The pickup point was in Venice, at a public parking lot 6 blocks off the beach. Bosch met McPherson there, and then he put a radio call into Wright, saying they were ready and waiting. 15 minutes later, a white SUV entered the lot and drove up to them. Bosch gave McPherson the front seat, and he climbed into the back. He wasn't being chivalrous. The long bench seat would allow him to stretch out during the long night of surveillance. "Steve Wright," the lieutenant said, offering McPherson his hand. "Maggie McPherson, thanks for letting me come along." "No sweat. We always like it when the district attorney's office takes an interest. Let's hope tonight is worth your while."
"Where's Jessup now?"
"When I left, he was at the brig on Abbot Kinney. He likes crowded places, which works in our favor. I have a couple of guys inside and a few more on the street. We're kind of used to his rhythm now. He hits a place, waits to be recognized, and for people to start buying him drinks, then he moves on, quickly if he isn't recognized."
"I guess I'm more interested in his late-night travels than his drinking habits."
"It's good that he's out drinking," Bosch said from the back seat. "There's a causal relationship. The nights he takes in alcohol are usually the nights he goes up to Mulholland."
Wright nodded in agreement and headed the SUV out of the lot. He was a perfect surveillance man because he didn't look like a cop. In his late 50s with glasses, a thinning hairline, and always 2 or 3 pens in his shirt pocket, he looked more like an accountant. But he had been with the SIS for more than 2 decades and had been in on several of the squad's kills. Every 5 years or so, the Times did a story on the SIS, usually analyzing its kill record. In the last expose Bosch remembered reading, the paper had labeled Wright SIS's unlikely chief gunslinger. While the reporters and editors behind the story probably viewed that as an editorial put-down, Wright wore it like a badge of honor. He had the sobriquet printed below his name on his business card. In quotes, of course. Wright drove down Abbot Kinney Boulevard and past the brig, which was located in a 2-story building on the east side of the street. He went 2 blocks down and made a U-turn. He came back up the street and pulled to the curb in front of a fire hydrant, a half block from the bar. The lighted sign outside the brig depicted a boxer in a ring, his red gloves up and ready. It was an image that seemed at odds with the name of the bar, but Bosch knew the story behind it. As a much younger man, he had lived in the neighborhood. He knew the sign with the boxer was put up by a former owner who had bought out the original owners. The new man was a retired fighter and had decorated the interior with a boxing motif. He also put the sign up out front. There was still a mural on the side of the building that depicted the fighter and his wife, but they were long gone now.
"This is 5, Wright said. "What's our status?"
He was talking to the microphone clipped to the sun visor over his head. Bosch knew there was a foot button on the floor that engaged it. The return speaker was under the dash. The radio set up in the cars allowed the surveillance cops to keep their hands free while driving and, more important, helped them maintain their cover. Talking into a handheld rover was a dead giveaway. The SIS was too good for that.
3, a voice said over the radio. "Retro is still in the location along with 1 and 2.
"Roger that," Wright said.
"Retro?" McPherson said.
"Our name for him," Wright said. "Our freaks are pretty far down the bandwidth, and on the FCC registry they're listed as DWP channels, but you never know who might be listening. We don't use the names of people or locations on the air."
"Got it." It wasn't even 9 yet. Bosch wasn't expecting Jessup to leave anytime soon, especially if people were buying him drinks. As they settled in, Wright seemed to like McPherson and liked informing her about procedures and the art of high-level surveillance. She might have been bored with it, but she never let on.
"See, once we establish a subject's rhythms and routines, we can react much better. Take this place, for example. The brig is one of 3 or 4 places Retro hits sort of regularly. We've assigned different guys to different bars, so they can go in while he's in the location and be like regulars.
The two guys I've got right now in the brig are the same two guys that always go in there. And two other guys would go into Townhouse when he's there, and two others have James Beach. It goes like that. If Retro notices them, he'll think it's because he's seen them in there before and they're regulars in the place. Now, if he saw the same guy at two different places, he'd start getting suspicious.
I understand, Lieutenant. Sounds like the smart way to do it.
Call me Steve.
Okay, Steve. Can your people inside communicate?
Yes, but they're deaf.
Deaf?
We've all got body mics, you know, like the Secret Service, but we don't put in the earpieces when we're in play inside a place like a bar. Too obvious. So they call in their positions when possible, but they don't hear anything coming back unless they pull the receiver up from under their collar and put it in. Unfortunately, it's not like TV, where they just put the bean in their ear and there's no wire.
I see. And do your men actually drink while in a bar on surveillance?
A guy in a place like that ordering a Coke or a glass of water is going to stand out as suspicious. So they order booze, but then they nurse it. Luckily, Retro likes to go to crowded places. Makes it easier to maintain cover.
While the small talk continued in the front seat, Bosch pulled his phone and started what some would consider a conversation of small talk himself. He texted his daughter. Though he knew there were several sets of eyes on the brig and even inside on Jessup, he looked up and checked the door of the bar every few seconds. Bosch typed, "How's it going? Having fun?" Madeline was staying overnight at her friend Aurora Smith's house. It was only a few blocks from home, but Bosch would not be nearby if she needed him. It was several minutes before she grudgingly answered the text, but they had a deal. She must answer his calls and texts, or her freedom, what she called her leash, would be shortened. Madeline texted back, "Everything's fine. You don't have to check on me." Bosch typed, "Yes, I do. I'm your father. Don't stay up too late." Madeline replied, "K." And that was it. A child's shorthand in a shorthand relationship. Bosch knew he needed help. There was so much he didn't know. At times they seemed fine, and everything appeared to be perfect. Other times, he was sure she was going to sneak out the door and run away. Living with his daughter had resulted in his love for her growing more than he thought was possible. Thoughts of her safety, as well as hopes for her happy future, invaded his mind at all times. His longing to make her life better and take her far past her own history had at times become a physical ache in his chest. Still, he couldn't seem to reach across the aisle. The plane was bouncing, and he kept missing. He put his phone away and checked the front of the brig again. There was a crowd of smokers standing outside. Just then, a voice and the sharp crack of billiard balls colliding in the background came over the radio speaker. "Coming out. Retro is coming out." "This seems early," Wright said.
"Does he smoke?" McPherson asked.
"Maybe he's just..."
"Not that we've seen."
Bosch kept his eyes on the door, and soon it pushed open. A man he recognized even from a distance as Jessup stepped out and headed along the sidewalk. Abbot Kinney slashed in a northwesterly direction across Venice. He was heading that way.
"Where did he park?" Bosch asked.
"He didn't," Wright said. "He only lives a few blocks from here. He walked over."
They watched in silence after that. Jessup walked two blocks on Abbot Kinney, passing a variety of restaurants, coffee shops, and galleries. The sidewalk was busy. Almost every place was still open for Saturday night business. He stepped into a coffee shop called Abbott's Habit. Wright got on the radio and assigned one of his men to enter it, but before that could happen, Jessup stepped back out, coffee in hand, and proceeded on foot again. Wright started the SUV and pulled into traffic going the opposite direction. He made a U-turn when he was two blocks further down and away from Jessup's view, should he happen to turn around. All the while, he maintained constant radio contact with the other followers. Jessup had an invisible net around him. Even if he knew it was there, he couldn't lose it.
"He's heading home," a radio voice reported. "Might be an early night."
Abbot Kinney, named for the man who built Venice more than a century earlier, became Brooks Avenue, which then intersected with Main Street. Jessup crossed Main and headed down one of the walk streets where automobiles could not travel. Wright was ready for this and directed two of the tail cars over to Pacific Avenue so they could pick him up when he came through. Wright pulled to a stop at Brooks and Main and waited for the report that Jessup had passed through and was on Pacific. After 2 minutes, he started to get anxious and went to the radio. "Where is he, people?" There was no response. No one had Jessup. Wright quickly sent somebody in. "Two, you go in. Use the 23.
"Got it."
McPherson looked over the seat back at Bosch and then at Wright. "The 23? "We have a variety of tactics we use. We don't describe them on the air." He pointed through the windshield. "That's the 23. Bosch saw a man wearing a red windbreaker and carrying an insulated pizza bag cut across Main and into the walk street named Breeze Avenue. They waited, and finally the radio burst to life. "I'm not seeing him. I walked all the way through, and he's not..." The transmission cut off. Wright said nothing. They waited, and then the same voice came back in a whisper. "I almost walked into him. He came out between two houses. He was pulling up his zipper." "Okay, did he make you?" Wright asked. "That's a negative. I asked for directions to Breeze Court, and he said this was Breeze Avenue. We're cool. He should be coming through now."
"This is four. We got him. He's heading towards San Juan."
The fourth car was one of the vehicles Wright had put on Pacific. Jessup was living in an apartment on San Juan Avenue between Speedway and the beach. One of his high school surfing buddies was putting him up until he cashed in. Bosch felt the momentary tension in his gut start to ease. Surveillance work was sometimes tough to take. Jessup had ducked between two houses to take a leak, and it had caused a near panic. Wright redirected the teams to the area around San Juan Avenue between Speedway and Pacific. Jessup used a key to enter the second-floor apartment where he was staying, and the teams quickly moved into place. It was time to wait again. Bosch knew from past surveillance gigs that the main attribute a good watcher needed was a comfort with silence. Some people are compelled to fill the void. Harry never was, and he doubted anyone in the SIS was. He was curious to see how McPherson would do now that the Surveillance 101 lesson from Wright was over and there was nothing left but to wait and watch. Bosch pulled his phone to see if he had missed a text from his daughter, but it was clear. He decided not to pester her with another check-in and put the phone away. The genius of his giving McPherson the front seat now came into play. He turned and put his legs up and across the seat, stretching himself into a lounging position with his back against the door. McPherson glanced back and smiled in the darkness of the car.
"I thought you were being a gentleman," she said. "You just wanted to stretch out."
Bosch smiled.
"You got me."
Everyone was silent after that. Bosch thought about what McPherson had said while they had waited in the parking lot to be picked up by Wright. First, she handed him a copy of the latest defense motion, which he locked in the trunk of his car. She told him he needed to start vetting the witnesses and their statements, looking for ways to turn their threats to the case into advantages for the prosecution. She said she and Holler had worked all day crafting a response to the attempt to disqualify Sarah Ann Gleason from testifying. The judge's ruling on the issue could decide the outcome of the trial. It always bothered Bosch when he saw justice and the law being manipulated by smart lawyers. His part in the process was pure. He started at a crime scene and followed the evidence to a killer. There were rules along the way, but at least the route was clear most of the time. But once things moved into the courthouse, they took on a different shape. Lawyers argued over interpretations and theories and procedures. Nothing seemed to move in a straight line. Justice became a labyrinth. How could it be, he wondered, that an eyewitness to a horrible crime would not be allowed to testify in court against the accused? He had been a cop more than 35 years, and he still could not explain how the system worked.
This is 3. Retro's on the move. Bosch was jarred out of his thoughts. A few seconds went by, and the next report came from another voice. He's driving. Wright took over. Okay, we get ready for an auto tail. 1. Get out to Main and Rose. 2. Go down to Pacific and Venice. Everybody else, sit tight until we have his direction. A few minutes later, they had their answer. North on Main. Same as usual. Wright redirected his units, and the carefully orchestrated mobile surveillance began moving with Jessup as he took Main Street to Pico and then made his way to the entrance of the 10 freeway. Jessup headed east and then merged onto the northbound 405, which was crowded with cars even at the late hour. As expected, he was heading toward the Santa Monica Mountains. The surveillance vehicles ranged from Wright's SUV to a black Mercedes convertible to a Volvo station wagon with 2 bikes on a rear rack to a pair of generic Japanese sedans. The only thing missing for a surveillance in the Hollywood Hills was a hybrid. The teams employed a surveillance procedure called the floating box. 2 outriders on either side of the target car, another car up front, and 1 behind, all moving in a choreographed rotation. Wright's SUV was the floater, running backup behind the box. The whole way, Jessup stayed at or below the speed limit. As the freeway rose to the crest of the mountains, Bosch looked out his window and saw the Getty Museum rising in the mist at the top, like a castle, the sky black behind it. Anticipating that Jessup was heading to his usual destinations on Mulholland Drive, Wright told 2 teams to break off from the box and move ahead. He wanted them already up and on Mulholland ahead of Jessup. He wanted a ground team with night vision goggles in Franklin Canyon Park before Jessup went in. True to form, Jessup took the Mulholland exit and was soon heading east on the winding 2-lane snake that runs the spine of the mountain chain. Wright explained that this was when the surveillance was most vulnerable to exposure. You need a B to properly do this up here, but that's not in the budget, he said. A B? McPherson asked. Part of our code means helicopter. We sure could use one. The first surprise of the night came 5 minutes later, when Jessup drove by Franklin Canyon Park without stopping. Wright quickly recalled his ground team from the park as Jessup continued east. Jessup passed Coldwater Canyon Boulevard without slowing, and next drove by the overlook above Fryman Canyon. When he passed through the intersection of Mulholland and Laurel Canyon Boulevard, he was taking the surveillance team into new territory. What are the chances he's made us? Bosch asked. None, Wright said. We're too good. He's got something new on his mind. For the next 10 minutes, the follow continued east toward the Cahuenga Pass. The command car was well behind the surveillance, and Wright and his 2 passengers had to rely on radio reports to know what was happening. 1 car was moving in front of Jessup while all the rest were behind. The rear cars followed a continual rotation of turning off and moving up so the headlight configurations would keep changing in Jessup's rear view. Finally, a radio report came in that made Bosch move forward in his seat, as if closer proximity to the source of the information would make things clearer. There's a stop sign up here and Retro turn north. It's too dark to see the street sign, but I had to stay on Mulholland, too risky. Next up, turn left at the stop. Roger that, we got the left.
Wait, Bosch said urgently. Tell him to wait.
Wright checked him in the mirror.
What do you have in mind? He asked.
There's only 1 stop on Mulholland. Woodrow Wilson Drive. I know it. It winds down and reconnects with Mulholland at the light down at Highland. The lead car can pick him up there. But Woodrow Wilson is too tight. If you send a car down there, he may know he's being followed.
You sure?
I'm sure. I live on Woodrow Wilson.
Wright thought for a moment, and then went on the radio.
Cancel that left. Where's the Volvo?
We're holding up until further command.
Okay, go on up and make the left on the 2-wheelers.
Watch for oncoming, and watch for our guy.
Roger that.
Soon, Wright's SUV got to the intersection. Bosch saw the Volvo pulled off to the side. The bike rack was empty. Wright pulled over to wait, checking the teams on the radio.
One, are you in position?
That's a roger. We're at the light at the bottom. No sign of Retro yet.
Three, you up?
There was no response.
Okay, everybody hold till we hear.
What do you mean? Bosch asked. What about the bikes?
They must have gone down deaf. We'll hear when they...
This is three, a voice said in a whisper. We came up on him. He'd closed his eyes and went to sleep. Wright translated for his passengers.
He killed his lights and stopped moving.
Bosch felt his chest start to tighten. Are they sure he's in the car?
Wright communicated the question over the radio.
Yeah, we can see him. He's got a candle burning on the dashboard.
Where exactly are you, three?
About halfway down. We can hear the freeway.
Bosch leaned all the way forward between the two front seats.
Ask him if he can pick a number off the curb, he said. Get me an address.
Wright relayed the request, and almost a minute went by before the whisper came back.
It's too dark to see the curbs here without using a flash, but we got a light next to the door of the house he's parked in front of. It's one of those cantilever jobs hanging its ass out over the pass. From here, it looks like 7203.
Bosch slid back and leaned heavily against the seat. McPherson turned to look at him. Wright used the mirror to look back.
You know that address?
Wright asked. Bosch nodded in the darkness.
Yeah, he said. It's my house.
Chapter 23. Sunday, March 21st, 6:40 a.m. My daughter liked to sleep in on Sundays. Normally, I hated losing the time with her. I only had her every other weekend and Wednesdays, but this Sunday was different. I was happy to let her sleep while I got up early to go back to work on the motion to save my chief witness's testimony. I was in the kitchen pouring the first cup of coffee of the day when I heard knocking on my front door. It was still dark out,